Okay. Right, thank you very much for coming. Good evening, everyone. My name's Ben Martill. I'm a lecturer in politics at the University of Edinburgh and an associate here at LSE Ideas. I'd like to welcome everyone warmly to the London School of Economics. And if you're already affiliated with LSE, then a very warm welcome to the ninth floor of Fawcett House. Very pleased to have you all here today. Today's event is called Silo Thinking, Systemic Marginalisation in Canada's Indigenous Communities. I think this is an event that's very topical at the moment for two reasons. Firstly, because it's a policy that Justin Trudeau's government has really sort of gone all in with and tied the Liberal brand to in recent years. And secondly, because in 12 days we have an all-important federal election in Canada. And so I think this is really the time to be talking about complex issues. With me today, we have two speakers. We have Matthew Eaton Kent, who's a barrister with his own practice based in Toronto and also a researcher at the Judicial Reform Project at Ryerson University in Toronto, where he focuses on youth and Indigenous communities. And Matthew is also, I'm pleased to announce, a graduate of the LSE. And we have our discussant today is Dr. Julia Himrick. Julia is a postdoctoral research fellow on the Dahrendorf Forum, researching the future of Europe, based here at LSE Ideas. She received her PhD from LSE, and she focuses on European foreign policy, on migration, and on the politics of recognition. So what's going to happen now is I'll hand over to Matt in just a second. Matthew's going to speak for approximately 45 minutes, then we'll hand over to Julia for the discussion, and then we'll have time for a Q&A. I should just point out at the moment that we are being recorded, so everything you say and all of your questions are being noted down and will feature on the podcast. So just to bear that in mind. So with that, we'll hand over to Matthew for his talk. Thank you, Matthew.
Sorry, if it's okay, I'm going to speak from the podium. I'm a little more comfortable that way. Thank you very much, Ben, for inviting me here. I'm, as a criminal defense lawyer, I'm very happy to be back at LSE to launder my reputation with the best of them. As Ben mentioned, I have had the pleasure of being able to work in the criminal justice field as a barrister, but also in the policy sphere. And in both of those areas, I've been able to work up closely with Indigenous people and see sort of the full brunt of what they have to experience in today's society. Although, of course, I don't experience it myself, so this is really just the perspective of somebody who observes some of the ways that the state comes down on them, but not somebody who feels the way that the state comes down on these people. So I guess that's a caveat to what I have to say. All right. I'm sure most people are familiar with Canada, but the large territory up there, Nunavut, that is one of the areas that I'm able to practice law in. And the first photo up there is one of the days that I was flying and then what I flew back to, just for contrast of what the weather is like up there on a October day like this. So the other project that I work on is a judicial reform project that is funded by the federal government, and that relates to youth in the child welfare sphere, because they are the highest portion of youth criminal justice charges. They make up the largest group far disproportionately. And so the government was funding a research project that was based in four locations across Ontario. So Toronto, Thunder Bay, Belleville, and Brantford. You can see at least how far Thunder Bay is from Toronto. It's a whole different world up there, and I had the opportunity also to fly to that area. There's a lot of Indigenous reserves. In fact, none of that large swath of land in Ontario, sort of above Thunder Bay, it's mostly uninhabited except for reserves for Indigenous people, and almost none of them have high schools. So they all fly down to Thunder Bay and spend 4 years if they get to high school going to high schools in the Thunder Bay area. And that, of course, causes, social, issues as well, being so far from home. And the community there, deals with the impact of that. Sometimes, they're trying their best, and in other ways, there's a lot of issues of racism, in that community. Just by way of pointing out all those different locations is to say that I've had the ability to look up close, in a variety of communities. And of course the, indigenous population, is one of the most targeted by the child welfare, sector as well. So, many of the overrepresented youth in the child welfare sphere, ended up having criminal justice charges based on the intervention of the state. So just very, very briefly, again, because this isn't obviously my area of expertise in terms of the history, but just to give some context, when the indigenous people first encountered European settlers, they were allies. They were sort of necessary for their survival originally. All the Europeans would have likely been wiped out upon landing had they not been taught some of the ways in which the indigenous people understood how to survive in the rough terrain. Secondly, once the Europeans started to feel settled and comfortable, they reignited conflicts that they had on the European territory with each other. And sort of by happenstance, some of the indigenous people were having conflict with each other, and they teamed up against each other. But they were seen as important. The British needed the Iroquois and the like. Their necessity diminished over time as, again, the military conquests were over and some of the Europeans, settlers settled their disputes. And when the countries started to the U.S. formed its borders, Canada was still part of the British territory, but at the very least wanted to protect their border so independence didn't continue. After the War of 1812, the indigenous people lost their value to the Europeans, and that changed the mindset in which the Europeans approached their relations with indigenous people. And the Canadian government in particular, not to distinguish it from the U.S. In fact, but just in terms of this discussion. So in Canada, the Canadian government played sort of a two-faced game where, one, it told the Europeans to come over and expand the Western territory, and they would give them land, and then they would turn around to the indigenous people and say, oh, you're so under threat from these out-of-control settlers, we will protect you by putting you in lands that we will, patrol and border, but they put them in areas that were unwanted. It becomes an issue later when resources are found underneath the territories and things like that. But originally these treaties, there was an element of where the indigenous people, were welcoming the help of the Canadian government. But there's a two-faced component to it. But that's important in that there were treaties signed where the government created a special relationship with the indigenous people. They promised them payment, annuities. Now, very small in comparison to the actual value of the land. But interestingly, there were certain benefits that were added into these treaties that played a larger role later on. It's kind of funny in the sense that the Canadian government, when Confederation originally happened, there was a lot of discounting of how important the education and healthcare and all these things would eventually become. And they were trying to make the federal government very powerful, and put all of the power in the federal government and not in the provinces, unlike sort of the disaster that happened in the U.S. But they sort of, the things they put in that other category ended up ballooning in importance. So another example of sort of maybe trying to undercut them even more. But to this day, the federal government is in charge of paying for the education of indigenous people. And that has led to, all kinds of atrocities, which I'll speak about. But, you know, it's not a benefit that the indigenous people want to give up lightly because, it's sort of the only, one of the only things that they, got out of it. So, the residential schools playing a large role, in, for those who don't know, part of the, what happened was under that guise of paying for, education, the, federal government in coordination with the churches in Canada, built a bunch of boarding schools around, taking the indigenous people off of their reserve, and educating them in these boarding schools. The problem, was that the, first of all, the quality of education was very low. So even on that guise, there was mostly sewing classes and other kinds of manual labor and a lot of Christian education. But then, you know, because they were isolated and the pool of people in which they hired from, meant that ultimately out of it, there was a tremendous amount of physical abuse, sexual abuse, and trauma that sort of lives on to this day. The 60s scoop, is another, sort of outcropping of the special relationship that Indigenous people in Canada have to the government, where the government has sort of a paternalistic, attitude, and certainly did have a paternalistic attitude towards that special relationship they had. And so the Children's Aid Societies went around to all the reserve communities, and found there were sort of protection grounds, so abuse, neglect, you know, all kinds of things. And they took children out of those communities, and then they just sent them off for adoption all around North America without telling them, you know, what connection they had or who they were. So, sort of a quiet genocide that happened to the indigenous people in that sphere. Also, the RCMP, they're sort of the federal police in Canada. They, as part of these treaties, they went up to protect these reserve lands. And again, originally, especially in the time where you had those settlers, it was a kind of Wild West in Canada as well, where Indigenous people were at risk for, being shot or the bootlegging that was going on, all of these things. And so they welcomed RCMP protection. But then when they got there, many of the people, whether it was on an individual basis or, you know, more tacitly approved of by the government, had underlying biases and did all kinds of terrible things. There's one example from Nunavut where, the RCMP came up and just slaughtered all the husky dogs in communities because that was sort of a source of power that Inuit people had. They hunted, sustained themselves on those dogs. They would be able to move from community to community all around the land. And the RCMP themselves, they didn't have the capacity or the fortitude to do that or to keep up with the indigenous people. So they just killed all their dogs and to subjugate them further. And that only happened sort of, maybe 60 plus years ago. Okay. So, again, just very briefly, there's a Supreme Court decision that this is a sort of a treaty interpretation one, Marshall, but just for these purposes, it recognizes that there's a special relationship and the government has special obligations in Canada to Indigenous people. Secondly, and I'll talk about these ones further, but Gladue and Epeli are two Supreme Court cases that relate to how Indigenous people should be treated in the criminal justice system. And it recognizes that the government has a responsibility for the fact that there's overrepresentation of Indigenous people in the court system. And so Gladue is a sentencing case. And for me, that's important because You know, that's only after you've been found sort of personally responsible. It's what do you do about it? And there are aggravating circumstances, which makes your sentence higher, and there are mitigating circumstances, which can make your sentence lower. And the court is saying that, you know, every Indigenous person that comes before the court, you need to think about whether there are mitigating circumstances that the state caused, that may make their sentence lower. And then on the other side, the child welfare side, there is a sort of there's a recognition that there's overrepresentation. There's some, some soul searching done about the response, whether they were protecting, these people when they, were taking them off the Indigenous reserves. And so they've created new, child welfare agencies that are Indigenous, have a jurisdiction over Indigenous lands that are come from the communities themselves, but you know how fully they're staffed and run, whether it's absolutely perfect, but at the very least they've started to have separate agencies, and there's also sort of certain new types of protection orders that can be made so that they're not just sent out for adoption or into the group care system. So customary care would just be a recognition that Indigenous communities often have a sort of a communal attitude towards raising children, so there might be a communal solution to custody. And then secondly, kinship would just be, you know, again, if there are other family members. But in my experience, you know, these are not fully taken advantage of, and there are many Indigenous children that get taken very far from their home. So the most important theme that arises from the work that I've been doing is trauma and the impact that trauma has on behavior. There are physical impacts that happen to the brain when you've experienced trauma, and they're much more likely to occur the younger the person is when they experience that trauma. The trauma, when a person is put in fight or flight mode, and you've all experienced this, adrenaline is released, your heart rate is elevated. There are chemicals that are released in your brain that help you to survive. It's how we have for, the entire of human history. So it's a very powerful response that's ingrained into you from evolution. And when that is triggered in young children, it causes them it shrinks the part of your brain that makes decisions, and you're much more likely to rely on that sort of lizard brain, the animalistic part of your response when you are encountering stressors. And the problem, and that sort of that continues until, if nothing's interrupted, that's the way your brain will evolve. The pathways will, the synapses will rewire in a way that makes that condition permanent until there's, you know, and we can talk about some of the ways in which that can be reversed. But it's especially important when we're talking about, you know, charging young people in the child welfare, right? So by definition, those are people who have experienced trauma, or otherwise there wouldn't be the grounds to remove them from their home. But that also applies to that should be a signifier, or an explanation for why there is overrepresentation of Indigenous people in the criminal justice sphere. Some of the behaviors that somebody who's experienced trauma will exhibit, for example, one would be numbing behavior, right? You want to keep your memories of that stress come back, and you try to calm the stress that it causes you. So you use alcohol or substances to calm yourself down. But of course, those only work sort of temporarily. And the more you become reliant on those, the more the less they work, and the more the dependency on the chemical itself is exacerbated. Another one of the symptoms would be, again, if you're in this fight or flight mode, you might react, right? So if you people who have experienced trauma are constantly trying to figure out ways to avoid being re-traumatized. Okay, so if you approach them suddenly, that kind of thing, it's possible that they may also kind of react in a violent way. And we see that a lot where, especially kids in group care, so where they're living in a home with many other kids, they get triggered, they get upset about something, or they feel like they're going to be attacked and they act out in a physical way. Another component of trauma is sometimes that people will be proactive in their traumatization. So like they want to be in control of when they get traumatized. So they provoke instances so that at least they know it's coming. And that can also apply in cases where there's been sexual abuse. So if they're sort of reacting that out, it can explain why they're engaging in that kind of activity. It's more so at the very least they have control over when it's going to happen. And so when you have, if trauma is so ingrained into has ingrained in your mind and has so much control over behavior, then the government has a lot of responsibility if it's the one that created the trauma in the first place. So particularly even sort of moving beyond now just sort of the worst cases where you have, the sexual abuse in the residential schools or the trauma that would have been created by the 60s scoop, but a lot of the solutions that we have for these issues are sort of traumatizing in and of themselves, right? So, okay, young person is being sexually abused at home. Solution, take them out of their home and community and put them in a place of safety. Okay, that at least stops the acute trauma. But being taken away from your family, taken away from your community, living somewhere that you don't know, that has a traumatizing component to it. Similarly, when you're talking about putting somebody in a custodial facility, isolating them, punishing them for what they did, that is traumatizing. So if the government plays a role in the original genesis of the trauma, and then its solutions for all of the trauma is just re-traumatizing, there's sort of a systemic perpetuation of the trauma that they caused in the first place. So, just to provide some anecdotes of the things that I saw, in Canada in sort of 2019, one community that I was working in, had a particularly high concentration of group homes. And so the community really, the local community really disliked, having those people living there. So they did not allow them, for the most part, to go to the local schools. Okay, if they did, they were in a school portable where they were not allowed to interact with the other children. They weren't allowed to participate in assemblies, singing the national anthem together, running cross-country meets at the same. They were not allowed to communicate to each other. And so what that creates is the group home operators who, are unsavory people, they then create, they say, well, oh, if we're going to house them here, we have to create schools for them here. And they sort of can't leave the property ever. They, they're not allowed to communicate to the outside world because there's fears that they'll get involved in human trafficking, or gangs. And so they don't let them go on the internet. They don't let them have phones, so they can't call back to their community. They can't run away and get back home. And they're living like, you know, a whole day's journey, even by plane, away from where they originally came from. I can't imagine living in a world in which I don't have the ability to communicate over the internet. And yet these kids are growing up in this parallel existence where they, you know, have access to maybe a movie on a VHS tape. And then you wonder why, they might get frustrated and throw a Tupperware container. And if they do that, then they get charged and they're deprived of liberty. They're, not mishandled in most cases, but, you know, the police are sort of allowed to use violence against them to force them to go into these, jails. So, some of these group homes are paid up to $1,000 a day, to house these children. And yet, all of the sort of discipline, the normal discipline of a house is offloaded onto policing, things that you would never dream to involve the police if it was your own family, where at most they might be sent to your room or grounded. Kid is charged, they're brought in front of court. We talk to a lot of them, and there's a tremendous amount of shame involved in those interactions, because it's such a low-level thing, and yet it's escalated to such a serious process where you're sitting in front of a judge and they're lecturing you on behaving. Even if, you know, there's not a large custodial sentence attached to it, they're still potentially overnight in jail at minimum. And then, you know, that's the kind of thing that causes disillusion, and then they do get in the cycle where they're going back and forth. And we put, you know, conditions on them. So, you have to do X, Y, and Z, and that criminalizes non-criminal conduct. And the court, you know, or certainly the police treat the word of the court incredibly seriously. And so any little deviation from some wording means automatically they're spending at least a night in jail. Tying it though to the topic, of siloing different government agencies, there was one case where there was the licensing for these group homes happens under one department, but the licensing of boarding schools happens under the education department. And there was an instance, and they are much more lightly regulated. So there was an instance of an operator who decided that they were going to be licensed under that. And then they went off to a Caribbean country and they advertised their services as a boarding school for people with, mental disabilities. And the parents spent tens of thousands of dollars to send them to this boarding school that was really just a house. And then the only reason it got discovered was because they eventually had to call the police because of some child pornography that had occurred in the home because of the mixing of different genders of children with mental disabilities. So you can see how that kind of segmenting, where you can do that regulatory arbitrage because the two aren't talking to each other, results in sort of, again, real world traumatization and the perpetuation of it. In one instance, one of the communities started to alert other child welfare agencies of some of the conditions in the local homes. And then because they're businesses, they just went further and further away trying to get new clients and ended up all the way in Nunavut when they couldn't get business anywhere else. And it was sort of, you know, too far to hear what was going on. And that sort of persists to this day. Talking about the court, so Nunavut is a fly-in only territory. There are no roads to get in at all. Any seafaring vessel, but there's you know, large shipping boats that come in and restock in the summer months. But for the most part, everything else you can only get in by plane. So that includes the court to any of these communities. So I've had the opportunity to be flown up all the way from Toronto to act as defense counsel in these court parties. And the size of the communities, the range from sort of there's 10,000 people almost in the capital, but then the other ones are sort of maybe a few thousand or less. And there are, you know, it's mostly Inuit people that live up there, and there's sort of a really typical script when you get up there. The court docket is full of assaults, breach of court order, sexual assaults, different property offenses, and almost all of them are because the person was blackout drunk when it happened. And so the there's a Supreme Court case. It's a little complicated, but it goes to how responsible people are when they're blackout drunk. And basically, they take the your intention from the drinking, and it's repurposed for the intention of the offense. And you know, on the one hand, it's understandable because you wouldn't want to just give anybody an excuse if they were blackout. That kind of means there's no laws to them. But at the same time, there's a reason that it's important to, you know, have had the intention to do something when you're doling out a punishment for that intention. Because if you don't, then what are you teaching them? What's the rehabilitation behind that? What lesson are they learning? And so the response to that would be, well, don't drink. But if the drinking is caused by having to forget all the things that have happened to you and all the things that have happened to your parents and all the things that have happened to their parents, I'll speak to this at the end, but you know, that's not the way that you undo trauma, and that's not the way people rehabilitate from those experiences. So I'll give a couple examples of things that I've observed and participated in up there. We had a young woman, and she had been the victim of very serious sexual abuse, and the police were aware of this because, you know, they had been the officers who had charged the people who had committed the sexual assault, and they'd participated in the trials where the people were eventually convicted. But she needs a lot of alcohol to cope with her daily life because of the trauma that she's experienced. And so she can be sometimes difficult for her family to deal with at their family home. And in two instances, the father went to the local police and said, you know, we really don't want you to charge our daughter, but she's just out of control in our home. Could you please come and remove her? Now, in Canada, unfortunately, a misconception, maybe it's like this in the States, but you don't have any control over whether the police charge somebody or not. If you provide evidence that form the basis of a charge, they're going to go charge. And maybe down the line, if you don't participate and you're necessary as a witness, the charges might be withdrawn. But you certainly can't go to the police and say, oh, you know, I just want you, the police, to show up and help me with this situation, but not charge the person involved. So she gets charged with, in both instances, now, again, you know, there's a distinction between, you know, certain provincial offenses where, you know, being drunk or whatever. There's no criminal charge of being intoxicated in Canada unless you're behind the wheel or something. But also, if you are causing a disturbance in a public place, that can be the form of the basis of a criminal charge. Or there's another one, mischief, for impeding the enjoyment of somebody's lawful property. But those are ridiculous charges to be criminally held responsible for, and they're rarely used in other parts of Canada, but they are charged all the time in Nunavut. And in both instances, In one instance, they ultimately don't even charge her with that. They just sort of form the grounds to, and that's where they start intervening physically. So in one instance, they had it was so of such low significance, they were going to just let her go off with a sober friend, but they couldn't find a sober friend, and there's no social services up there where they could have left her. So they decide, fine, we're just going to arrest her. That's sort of our only solution that we have to this situation. She's cooperative up to the point where they're telling her, now we're going to charge you. So she's resisting a bit, and they drag her into the station, and they fall to the ground, and then they pin her down. One officer holds her arms behind her head, and then the other officer starts trying to rip her sweater off. And the reason they try to rip her sweater off is because there's some vague policy that says there's a safety concern if you have extra clothes on. They might harm themselves in the cell. Okay. But there's no discussion about that they're going to take this off. They're working cross purposes. And she's a known victim of sexual assault. So she, reacts to that, doesn't like that. She kind of flips over on her back. They try again. They pull her shirt sort of halfway up. They don't quite get it. And then on the second, turn, the officer gets kicked in the face. So, all of this, and then, this person is tried, right? There's no even recognition from the officers after the fact that maybe that wasn't the best idea. And then it turns out they actually didn't, according to the policy, need to take the sweater off. They could have just taken the string out, which is what they ultimately do because they decide it's too much hassle to have done that in the first place. There's a second instance, where similarly she, is with, the father reports that she's causing a disturbance. The other, she's with a boyfriend, and the boyfriend's not supposed to be, she's bound by court order not to be around, this person. And the officers, show up, and sure, like, that guy could be arrested. He's not supposed to be there. But she's just calmly smoking a cigarette, and they decide they're gonna arrest her. One officer later testifies that the reason was because he was aiding and abetting. She was aiding and abetting the breach of the court order. The court order that was there to protect, this person. And so they, arrest her. Somebody films it. The Crown, discloses the video, although there's 1 second missing, and that 1 second is, her, being kicked by the officer. So we, found that extra 1 second and put that to the officer as well. But she, is arrested and taken to the ground, all because, she was sort of, causing a disturbance on her front porch. There's many instances of that. There's another one, a victim of many, abuses. She was called, the police were called, her drunk partner was, said he was assaulted. They turn up. She says, no, I was just trying to prevent him from getting on his snowmobile intoxicated. And they charge her for assault. And, I tried to get a judicial stay out of it, not even having to have her go into these diversion programs and other things. But the court wouldn't take that step. So, why I bring up these anecdotes is because it speaks to a larger picture where in the court process, we're very concerned with all of these different tests to, whether it's admissibility or to impute responsibility. Similarly, when social workers are coming in to, take someone away, they're, looking at whether they meet the grounds, that if abuse is enough to have the child taken away. But nobody is thinking about the larger effect of this stuff and whether what are we really doing here is by going through all of these steps, which maybe logically follow from each other, are we really solving the problems that we're trying to solve? And for me, it's just so plain when you go up there and it's all Indigenous people. And it's all because, for the most part, they've drank too much and something's happened, that a court party that flies in and throws some of them in jail at the end of it. And some of them, you know, they go free because we followed these tests and, you know, there's not enough for beyond a reasonable doubt, or, you know, the admissibility of this thing. And it's, you know, it's great to fight all of those fights. But at the same time, at the end of it, nothing is happening about the larger picture. And there are these underlying assumptions in these tests that I think are responsible for why we are where we are. So one of them being, custody as a rehabilitative tool. There's no evidence that putting somebody who's experienced trauma, who's committed an offense because they're blackout drunk, is in any way going to fix them when they get out. It's only going to contribute to more social breakdown, and it's going to keep that intergenerational trauma they've experienced be passed on at the highest level because of the acute trauma that those people are facing. So, and similarly, you know, when you're talking about a child custody, protection, you know, the social workers are in there with the best of intentions to protect the child, but the way that they're doing it is traumatizing in and of itself and is destroying the fabric of the communities in which these children are pulled out. And it's not going to fix them, having them be in these homes. And so just the larger, the fact that all of these departments and professionals are so specialized in what they do, and so focused on the part of the social fabric for which they have a mandate for, means that we just lose the larger picture of the experience that Indigenous people are having. Again, it applies beyond that, but you can just see how all of these sort of parts of justice or whatever that are parachuted in only deal with such a small component of it. And that there just needs to be a more comprehensive, holistic approach if there's ever going to be a tackling of these issues.
All right. Okay, right. Thank you very much, Matthew. Thank you very much for that incredibly sobering talk. Obviously, lots of really difficult questions that come out of that, and I think, in a sense, a snapshot of a huge problem that I can't imagine as easy answers. What I'm going to do now is hand over for about 10 minutes or so to Julia Himrick, who's going to provide a discussion, and then we'll go to the audience for comments and questions. So thanks, Julia.
Thanks. Thank you very much for that talk, and thanks, Ben, for inviting me to give a few comments. I mainly would like to, just bring some questions, things that I was thinking about while you're speaking as well. And I think there's definitely scope for a good discussion with the audience, so I don't want to take too much time. But thank you for really bringing out this issue about trauma and how that affects the trauma that is being passed on through generation, how it affects the situation today, and how basically the state or the policy of the state is inherently unable to address it or actually deal with this issue that I think is really inherent to post-genocidal and post-colonial societies. And it's definitely not just Canada, but many other countries that we would consider liberal democracies. And I think you brought out really well how there's really this clash of how Canadians might want to perceive themselves as the state helping out this marginalized community, but actually just not acknowledging its own role in the trauma enough, and actually make it worse to that extent. So I would be really interested to hear, obviously, if you could expand more on that last point that you made about, you know, what should that change look like and what would be necessary. But something that really struck me, and something you also mentioned, this whole image of, you know, a court flying out there, basically this institution coming there, taking over the lives of these people, basically judging, making the decision of you go to jail or you don't go to jail, and then flying back out. There's this really, I think, throughout your presentation, this whole contrast between the state, the institution on the one hand, and then these groups on the other, and how there is really no understanding of each other. And I was wondering if you've seen in your work how, if there are opportunities for actually for this community itself to become part of the system more, become part of that reform that is necessary. Because obviously, you know, becoming a lawyer or becoming a judge involves a lot of education, expensive education also. I mean, or in Canada, obviously it's not as expensive. But basically it is difficult to get into this profession. And if there are ways actually to develop, advocates from the community, to inform policy and also really inform the whole reform of the criminal justice system, that is able, people that are also understanding of this trauma and how that could be addressed. It doesn't mean that anyone from the community would be well placed to do so, but I do think that, at least from how you presented it, there did seem to be very little overlap of these two groups. And I was wondering if you could discuss a bit more that. There were obviously also big issues about child welfare, child rights that just seemed to be completely ignored. And that really struck me, the institutionalization of care for children that you would think we've kind of moved away from. And maybe you can speak a little bit about that. Obviously, there is this whole system behind and also the private sector behind now that has an interest in maintaining this. Yeah. But within the Canadian system, I'm just wondering how can you, is that common practice that actually also, is it common to put children into homes for any other community, or is this something that really is just, mainly prevalent for them? And that really struck me how that is still possible in this day and age. And then also because you mentioned quite a few, issues around sexual violence and or sexual abuse of children, and that this kind of, let's say, the first trauma that these children face on a personal level. There's obviously a big gender aspect to that, and how you see that this could be maybe addressed in a more, because it becomes quite a complex situation. Something we've seen also with other communities where maybe we have victims of sexual violence. And then often the state sees it simply through a more mainstream gender lens, but then actually is unable to address the issue more in a sustainable way. So if there's something that you could, maybe you've seen different approaches that work or don't work, or what could be the underlying issue there. I think these are basically the points that really jumped out at me while you were speaking, and like I said, I don't want to take too much time, so I'll hand over to you and then to the audience.
Can I suggest, Matt, to take a couple of those maybe, and then we'll go over to the audience?
So very briefly on the issue of sort of the responsibility of the government, you know, to me what's most important about the last official residential school in our country closed in 1997. But I think there's a, you know, when we're talking about the state responsibility, I think it actually falls to the people in our society, because it's a democracy, to have a recognition. I think there's a really prevalent attitude of, you know, this is such an intractable problem. Why are there so many Indigenous people who just keep committing crimes? Like, come on, guys, stop doing that. But it's like those schools just closed, and most of the survivors are still alive. And maybe they're grandparents now, but some of the sort of unhealthy habits or things they're still in there. There's a whole generation of residential school survivors who have a very different attitude towards the younger generations, towards their Indigenous heritage. And the younger generations are getting more and more interested in the older teachings and the older ways. But there's a whole segment that is very Christianized, but also holds the scars of those trauma, and they raised children, and those children raised children. And so the linkage to those schools, even the ones that, you know, closed in the 60s or 70s, they're very fresh. And so the idea that, for people in the society to think about this as sort of a personal responsibility narrative is just wrong and short-sighted. And I think until there is a wider acceptance and advocacy on that from the people, then the government's not going to listen and is actually going to sort of take the opposite tact, because that's kind of where their legitimacy comes from. In terms of the private group homes and child rights, I mean, it's they're, you know, I said the in 1997 the last official group home closed, or the last official residential school closed, because really there are still residential schools. They operate exactly the same way. In fact, they're smaller and more isolated. There's likely less sort of sexual violence and overt physical violence going on, but all of that cultural genocide is still going on. I mean, there's and just the trauma and the isolation. So they privatized it. There's a tremendous amount of profit in it. The group homes, we had a lot of the kids tell us that they'd prefer to be in some of the custodial facilities because there's sort of more regulation and they're paid more and there's higher education requirements for the people that work there. So, there's not a lot of respect for the pure children's rights. And they put them in these places because they say, oh, the kids are out of control and what are we going to do? And it escalates. But it's just a system, and it's endless. I'll just lastly touch on gender. I think that's probably the hardest part of dealing with this, especially in the criminal context, because, of course there is a vulnerable population, that there is sort of a oppression, that's going on because of the male-female dynamic, and, you know, possibly that existed far before, there was colonial intervention, and, it's likely been exacerbated by the trauma that's been afflicted by the state, but it may not be explain all of it. But the problem of having sort of flying commute courts with their only solution being they sort of have a couple tools to play, and custody being the last resort, but there's a lot of, many of the communities don't have access to like spousal abuse, programs and things like that. And the ones that do, they're only available for so far. And then if it's anything beyond then it's, we're just escalating the consequences. So in terms of different approaches, I think more than anything, government departments and agencies need to be collaborating with each other to understand what happens if you do X in this other department. And the easiest is something like a spousal abuse program or some of these counseling or other things that are seem like the easiest thing to cut. But then that, like, there is a straight line between not having that program and then, them having to be in custody and how much it costs to house somebody in jail. So, I really feel the idea of one ministry sort of bailing out a sinking boat into the other part of the boat, is what's going on. And there just aren't people whose responsibility is to look at what is happening. What are the consequences in the other areas?
Okay, brilliant. Right. So we've got half an hour left for questions and for comments from the audience. I don't know if we have roving mics. It looks like we do. Okay, so if you could just put your hand up if you have a question or a comment, And if you could just say your name as well for the podcast. Yep.
Is it on? Thank you for that. That was really interesting. It seemed like you were talking primarily about these sort of remote communities and sort of attributing part of the problem of the violence of the state to the fact that there are these flying courts and not sort of a, the state is remote from the communities themselves. But I think there's pretty strong evidence that, that similar systemic violence happens in cities and other contexts where the state is much more omnipresent. So I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit as to, why you think it's particularly important to start tackling these issues in remote communities and whether there's a role for urban communities as well.
Yeah, I mean,
should we take them in rounds first? Any more questions, comments? Yeah, gentleman here then at the front.
Chris Hume, you mentioned the fact that some of the people that you've dealt with prefer to go to a place of custody rather than some of the institutions because the educational standards are higher. And I wonder to what extent the basic picture that you're painting of essentially a very unsubtle, cack-handed state as it exists in these settlements in Nunavut is partly because it is difficult for the state realistically to get people with reasonable quality education to perform duties in a place where the capital settlement is 10,000 people. I mean, you're good.
Yeah. Okay, and at the front here.
Thank you, Patricia Rebetkoa. Thanks for the great talk. Really fascinating to hear about what's happening up in Nunavut. I have two questions. First of all, I felt quite acutely that, you know, the police force is a big part of the problem. They seem to be too sort of trigger happy in these situations. Has there been any movement regarding greater representation of the indigenous communities in the police force? Are there any rules regarding that in place? And then my second question was, you mentioned the historical context and arguably, things are getting better over time. The government isn't treating these communities as harshly as they used to. I mean, do we see some improvement when you look at the numbers of these, you know, trivial offenses? Do we see some, improvement over time?
Okay, so tackling the first one, the reason I'm talking about remote communities in the indigenous context is because that's where the government sent them all. And so this absolutely applies to urban settings, and it applies to communities that are marginalized in urban settings as well. But particularly the part of the remoteness for these communities is what cuts them off economically and socially. And in fact, in Nunavut, because it's a newly created territory and there's a much more the government up there is there's a mostly Inuit people that run the government and participate in the running of the government. There's a lot of economic development up there, and much of it goes back to the communities itself. So they're in a lot better place than some of the other remote indigenous communities, for example, in the north of Ontario, like I was discussing. So I think that's really it's not so much. Or it's not just the remoteness, it's the fact that they have been sort of systemically cut off from economic and social development. That is one of the things that contributes to the overrepresentation in the criminal justice system. It's just sort of my experience in the remote and communities and that they are put there. I work in downtown Toronto in a large metropolitan area, and the same can be said. In fact, you know, one of our sites dealt with marginalized, African Canadian children that had similar experiences. When we're talking about, custody facilities I was mentioning where people would prefer to be there, that's only children and it's only an open custody facility. So those are like, they're basically group homes that are run by the state rather than by a private, enterprise. And because, you know, you're sort of next step up, into a custody facility, there's just different sort of regulatory requirements and thus they're sort of better run. And so when those kids contrast the two, they prefer those ones. But, you know, none of the people who are in the large metropolitan jails are preferring being, in those custodial facilities. Now, you know, there is one of the custodial facilities in Nunavut is particularly, run down and there's been a lot of issues, there. And so certainly, you know, there is, you know, something to be said, about it being the remote northern, making it difficult. But, you know, when we're talking about the child welfare aspect of my, policy work, that was in Toronto, a large city, Brantford and Belleville. Those are, you know, places that are all connected by road and, you know, everybody's doing, you know, decently well economically there. So, I think it's not so much, about the physical challenges of the government, but just, I really think it has to do with different ministerial portfolios and how everybody's striving to, you know, streamline their budget and get everything that's important to them, paid for. And then when, you know, when you multiply that across every department or, you know, the specializations, all the lawyers are really interested in preserving the, you know, rights, the liberty of their client in the court process, but less concerned about what happens when they leave, you know, the court or, the child welfare work, the social worker who's very concerned about protecting the child when they come across it. But then once they sort of hand them off to a place that they consider safe, that's sort of outside of their purview now. And all that kind of, segmentation just allows for large gaps for, you know, people to take advantage of. So, you know, when we talk about the police force, you know, there is some, I think it's particularly difficult in a place, where it's not that it's difficult, but structurally, I think they find it difficult to get, people. And so, yeah, it is a lot of white officers, but I know that there are, you know, when we talk about policing in Toronto, there are a lot of, you know, black officers or some, you know, indigenous communities have, indigenous officers. But, you know, to me, I think that, and this is a real generalization, but there's a general mentality that someone has to have to want to be a police officer, just somebody who likes to enforce, rules. And I found that there's a general kind of personality of the officers I encounter. So, again, there has been instances, where that rule hasn't been, followed through on and how, you know, sometimes that does come down to, the person having that lived experience and then can translate it. But it's a real, there's a certain mindset of being a police officer and there's a certain cultural attitude in those institutions. And so I think it goes beyond just who you're hiring, but also what goals you're telling police to accomplish. And if it's just merely, enforcing order, then you're going to get instances where they're just trying to, you know, control people who are chaotic, but those are often people who are, you know, traumatized and have other things going on and clamping down on them is going to be counterproductive, to that goal. But there's not a wide acceptance of that, I don't think, in our police forces. And in terms of improvement, again, it's of course, sort of the worst abuses are, in the past, there, you know, the idea that, you know, some of the overt attitudes, that went on that led to the most degrading, dehumanizing, practices are gone. But, you know, I just think you'd be surprised when you scratch the surface that in those moments where things are sort of most, chaotic, that, You know, there are officers that'll strip indigenous people naked and just leave them in the cell for 12 hours. And, you know, okay, ultimately the charge is stayed against the person and they're not going to go to jail. But, you know, nothing's going to happen to that officer. So,
yeah, sorry, Julia, you want to come back in?
I mean, I don't know if there are any other questions from you. I just wanted to follow up on something you said, and I feel it's coming out from your answers a little bit. I think there's this, because you mentioned the general understanding in the, you know, in the majority population in Canada, that this is kind of like, they're just, why don't they just stop being alcoholics? Why don't they just stop doing all these petty crimes and things? And I think that seems to be always the underlying discourse when we talk about basic issues in marginalized communities, that it's, we need to somehow convince first the majority population that this is an issue, even though, like you pointed out, trauma has been proven, it's very clear what's been happening, there's a clear documentation of how these processes repeat themselves and how it's, you know, they haven't really been addressed, but still, they need to become an issue that is relevant enough to the, you know, middle-class white people in Canada, so they're like, oh yeah, maybe the state should invest in this, or maybe we do need to find other solutions to this. And this is obviously quite tiring, I can imagine. But how do you deal with that? Is it a question of education, and then who should be the ones educating it? And maybe that goes back also to what I was saying earlier. How can we get the voice of the people actually affected by this to be more part of the solution and bring it out a little bit more.
Yeah. Let's add some more questions and comments to those, and then Matt, you can deal with all of them. So if we go back to the audience, any more questions, comments? Yes, at the back there.
Hi. I wanted to ask you, because you said earlier, this is kind of following up on what you were saying too, that it really depends up to like normal people in Canada, like common citizens, to really work on reconciliation. But in my personal experience living in Toronto, I've met people all across the political spectrum, but who are also very united in the fact that they're all very anti-Indigenous, very racist, despite not really knowing any of them and not really knowing about any of their issues. What do you think is the way forward for promoting a general reconciliation, especially considering that the federal government just decided to appeal the case with welfare where they had to pay $40,000 to each child there? And that most Canadians that I've met do see it as a good thing, even though they don't know, obviously, what people go through in those cases.
Okay, thank you very much. Any more questions and comments?
Can I just ask you?
Do you want to wait for the microphone? Yeah. Thanks.
I just don't know the circumstances, but I mean, it sounds very much like a massive policing problem in terms of the general approach of the local police to issues, and whether they charge and whether they're actually aware of and trained in potential alternatives. If somebody is blind drunk, keeping them in the cells overnight and then releasing them in the morning when they're sobered up. I mean, is this all federal policing? Is there no local potential police force, or could there be a local police force? Is there any local legislation? Does Nunavut actually have, for example, the ability to create provincial law in the same way as Ontario or Quebec or BC?
Okay, thanks. Yep.
Yeah. So, in terms of motivating the general public, I think, you know, part of it sort of, I think there's got to be a twofold strategy. One is, because it would be easier, is just trying to, the people who are involved in justice on a daily basis, trying to convince those actors that punishment isn't the way to go when it comes to these issues, and sort of similarly try to bring that message to the general public. So, you know, it might be harder to convince them to, you know, spend their tax dollars on building, you know, schools and clean water, as crazy as that sounds. But at the very least, you know, not having them spend even more tax dollars, housing them in institutions that are counterproductive to the problem that we're trying to solve. But I think it is, you know, difficult, because all that sort of people see If they do see it, because again, a lot of this stuff happens in remote communities that doesn't affect, you know, the majority voting population. But when it does come into the urban centers, yeah, there's a lot of a visceral reaction to the, you know, externalizations of that trauma, the, you know, public intoxication, that kind of stuff. But, and so to me, I think the message just being like, trying to teach people about trauma. And I really think the idea of intergenerational trauma is so remote to people, and they're so skeptical and unwilling, to internalize that. But, at sort of at the very least, trying to, spread the message of not punishing people for those emotions, but sort of, I think, easier to take that message to sort of the decision makers in the judiciary, because so much of what happens in the court very rarely kind of trickles out, and when it does, it can create all this chaos. But I think the people who could do the most impact, who are most readily interested in the message, are those judicial gatekeepers and government policymakers. When we're talking about general reconciliation, I think it is very difficult to get people who only see this as a, you know, something that is a line item budget, you know, for their taxes, and not something that you know, they see on a general, in a general basis. But, so I don't know if I have a good answer of how to promote, general reconciliation, because it is really so, ingrained, that idea that they're greedy and they just still want and want and want, and how come they can't figure it out. But I think there's a great shame, in Canada, I think what something that's very important to Canadians is how they're viewed externally, and I think it's a great one of our great shames that we have people in our country that are living in third world conditions. And you know, Jasmeet Singh did a very good job shutting down the question recently of whether you know, it was too much to promise for clean water. And I, you know, I think that was a very effective way of doing it, just really being utterly shocked at the question. And I think that is maybe something that sometimes people aren't fully, and he did it in a very diplomatic way, but if you just sort of frame it of like, what are you talking about? Like, because there's a language, and I think the media actually is, partly responsible for it, and the government is responsible for it as well, of just sort of casually talking or questioning things as if they're not basic fundamental rights, and framing it as kind of, oh, we'll get a punchy quote in the newspaper, or, you know, we'll be able to rile up some people with this information. I think there is a responsibility to re-examine some of these underlying assumptions as well. And then just turning to policing. So the criminal code that, you know, so basically anything that's, criminal, that you can be criminally charged for, that's federal, jurisdiction. There is, you know, local, like city police in certain provinces, as well as provincial police in some. The territory of Nunavut just happens to only use the RCMP, but I don't think it is just about like local ordinances. I think it's a larger problem that relates to the culture of policing that happens both at the local, at the provincial, and at the federal level. But I do have some sympathy for officers who are just sort of going about their daily duties, and how difficult it would be to be confronted with violence in the workplace, and the risks and uncertainty that these interactions can pose, but at the same time, so many of their tactics are ones that escalate things further and make it more unsafe for them. And it's just whether it's problems of the individual's inability to self-regulate, or some of the tactics that are taught, or some of the regulations that they're required to follow. That's kind of why I think it's important that there are people that are who are responsible for the larger picture, and who see that, okay, yes, we have acute safety concerns about this person potentially committing suicide in custody, and that's real, and it shouldn't be discounted. But at the same time, there are many ways to achieve that same goal, and to really highlight for police which ones of those tactics are going to make things worse based just on how humans naturally react to things. And again, you know, I understand that there's a mentality of dominating to get control of the situation, and that's supposed to reduce the risk to officers. But I think in so many instances, it takes situations that where there's little to no safety concern and escalates them into things that, you know, cause trauma.
Okay, we've got it's the final opportunity to ask questions unless you want to accost Matthew afterwards. So final round of questions and comments. Okay, in that case, I have one question for you. I will give the others 30 seconds or so to think up more. So in a sense, does this, and I appreciate you're not necessarily talking about politics here, does this mean that Trudeau's kind of mainstreaming of Indigenous rights is a failure, or is this, in a sense, taking us towards public understanding, sort of better public understanding, and it's a longer-term thing? And with the election coming out, what happens to Indigenous rights questions under the Conservatives, and far less likely, perhaps, what happens under an NDP government or an NDP Liberal coalition? And one final opportunity for questions, if you thought of one. Yeah, another question. Oh, Frank, that's absolutely fine.
I just wonder whether you've looked at similar issues in other countries as well, particularly ones with parallel histories like Australia.
So there's something that Julie said that actually reminded me, and she was asking what role do Indigenous people have in this? You know, what role should they play? And, you know, I mean, it's certainly up to them, but I really do find it, you know, unfortunate that sort of people who have been victimized are being required to advocate for the end of their victimization, right? And that responsibility really does still fall to the state and the civilization of people that, or the society of people that perpetuated that victimization. And so, you know, when we're talking about the longer term, sorry, repeat your question, the first time.
What happens if it's a Conservative government?
Yeah, so in the longer term, this issue, there are, you know, every day that there's an increasing consciousness, and I'll hate this term, but wokeness in society, the more pressure it puts onto the government. And, you know, it's funny because I think Justin Trudeau is best with the larger picture than, with the details. And so it's sort of shocking to me that he hasn't put more pressure on the government departments that have a role, in these issues to look at the larger picture and achieve the kind of, goals that he exalts in public, and that too much there hasn't been enough micromanaging on his part, and the departments have just been kind of left up to themselves to continue the way that they've always done and not allow the floodgates to open. And, you know, maybe he's making a political calculation because if he doesn't, there'll be a backlash and the conservatives will come in and there'll be kind of reactionary policies that end a lot of the progress that has been made. But, you know, if there were to be a NDP minority coalition, I would hope that one of the things that was a priority for the leader of the NDP was to really abolish the mindset that he was so admonishing in his press conference on water, and make the kind of nickel and diming a thing of the past, because it's terrible economics too. Like, you're just wasting the potential of such a valuable resource by subjugating it for so long. And in terms of, you know, I haven't had the opportunity to look at indigenous communities in other countries, but I have recently had the opportunity to work with lawyers and social workers who live under another oppressive regime, and I won't actually name that regime for their protection. But trauma really pervades in those in that state, and it just bleeds into everything. And so I would suspect that sort of any community around the world that has a long history of trauma, whether it's usually state-sponsored or otherwise, but communities that have experienced war, it's no wonder that there are different attitudes in those communities towards punishment or how to deal with problems and sort of the brutality through which those societies sometimes interact with each other. I think is sort of you could see a really direct line in that state that I was working with people in.
Okay, that's all we have time for. Thanks very much for coming along. I'd like to thank LSE Ideas for hosting us as well, in particular to Dora, Dave, Jess and Amelia for helping to pull this event together. There are feedback forms. You're either sat on them or they're available at the back. So please tell us what you thought about the event, when anything we can improve. And could you please join me in thanking Matthew and Julia for their talks.